Hello, this is Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I've got a really terrific guest with me today, Dr. Lena Nguyen from Baltimore, where she is the Public Health Commissioner. And we're going to get into, a terrific conversation. So, Lena, welcome. Welcome to Medscape.
Thank you very much. I'm a big fan of your work, and I'm really delighted to be able to speak with you and your readers and viewers.
Well, thanks so much for joining. And I guess what I wanted to get in first, there's so much to talk with you about. You're actually a really fascinating person. I know we met back at the end of June at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and now we finally get into chance to get back to your background and what's going on there in Baltimore. So to start with, as I understand it, you came to the U.S. from China around age 8, and you started college at age 13. Is that right?
You know, I was very lucky early on to have good mentors, but also to have the inspiration of my mother in particular, who always emphasized that education is the most important thing. I mean, I didn't speak English when I came to this country. We're immigrants. We lived in some very difficult areas, very economically challenged areas in East LA and in South LA. And it just, you know, my classmates were the ones who were teen moms. They were the ones who were the victims and the perpetrators of gun violence. I saw what happens with substance addiction and lack of mental health and lack of physical health services all around me. And that's certainly what spurred me to enter medicine, and in particular to focus on public health as the underlying issues why we're here today.
Yeah, well, that's actually extraordinary how you had a jump start at an early point in your life. Now, you went from Cal State to Washington University for med school, is that right? And then you were a Rhodes Scholar after that, right?
Amazing. Right. I just got very lucky, I think. And I took, I was fortunate again in my medical education to meet some just tremendous mentors who helped me figure out what I wanted to do. Because when you're early in your medical training, I mean, we're all idealistic. We all want to do the right thing. We all enter medicine for the right reason. But I didn't know where I should go and how I could do it. And I actually remember being in medical school, and I think I was in my second year. I was so dispirited because I didn't think that I entered medicine to study science I wanted to be evidence-based and science-focused, but it just wasn't the right fit. And I kept on thinking, but what should I be doing to help my community? You know, how can I be an advocate for my patients? And I'm really lucky to have had people to encourage that path instead of telling me, well, medicine is not for you, or forget about doing this in your medical career.
Yeah, no, it's very striking. Now, you decided to become an emergency medicine specialist, right? So what prompted you to go into that discipline?
I loved the idea of never turning away any patient. I wanted to be able to treat anyone who came through my door, regardless of whether it's a three-week-old baby, 98-year-old woman, to be able to treat traumas and medical emergencies. But as importantly, I never wanted to turn any patient away. And I wanted a field where no matter if the patient has any ability to pay or anything, that I would treat them with the same dignity, the same respect, and give them the same medical care as the member of Congress who would walk in through my door as well. And I think, you know, one of my mentors in emergency medicine, Dr. Earl Reisdorf, would say, look, this is the one area, the one field where we can treat every single person with that human dignity and respect that they really deserve. Mm-hmm. And for many of our patients, it's true that many of our patients are homeless, they're addicted to drugs, they're recently incarcerated, they don't have other people who are kind to them and who may just see them as that guy down the street who we see all the time, the homeless guy, the drunk guy, or whatever adjectives that we may place. But this is our opportunity to treat every individual the same and to give them that basic human respect. But I think it's also in the ER. I mean, we are the front doors to public health in every way. We see what happens with infectious disease outbreaks. We're actually dealing with a possible case of measles here in the city as we speak. And we also see violence as a public health issue. And we see how unsatisfying it could be at times, too, when we know that what this patient needs is not just sleeping off their opioid overdose, or they don't just need Narcan. What they need is attention to their undiagnosed mental illness. What they need is housing. What they need is food. What they need is assistance for their other social needs. And so I think it's also, it's the ER where we see all these problems, but I think it's also in the ER that we can make a lot of interventions that really do get to the core of what our patients need.
Well, you make a really terrific case for as the emergency room, kind of the front doors of public health. You know, I'm not aware of any of the big public health, high profile people with that background. Most of them have epidemiology and population medicine background. So it seems somewhat unique to me, but maybe I'm not familiar with all the folks who have gone from emergency medicine to this walk of public health in a city that we're going to get into that responsibility for Baltimore's public health. But before we do that, let's just review. You got into blogging, I guess. It was about the doctor is listening. That was an interesting time because you were one of the early people among the medical community to get into blogging. And can you tell us a little bit about why you did it and what that experience led to?
Absolutely. And it actually was born out of an unfortunate experience, and one that's deeply personal to me. When I was a second year medical student, my mother was misdiagnosed for over a year before she was finally diagnosed with what turned out to be metastatic breast cancer, cancer that by then had widely spread, including to her lungs, her bones, and her brain. And over the course of her illness, it exactly coincided also with my medical training. And I saw how much doctors being to do well. I mean, all my classmates, our professors, our attendings, our residents, they meant to do the right thing. But it still was so separate from what our patients and our family members are experiencing, because I saw that side of it too. And I saw that disconnect that's occurring, but not because it's anybody's fault. But there are things that we can do, low-hanging fruit that we can do, but we can also focus on bigger pictures, like how is it that we can encourage doctors to listen better to their patients? How can we focus on the fact that 80% of diagnoses can be made by listening? How can we get back to the diagnosis and why that's so central? And how can we really do patient-centered care and not just check it off on a box of saying, we've now consulted a patient and therefore it's patient-centered, or we've talked to one community member and that's community participatory research. I mean, there's a tendency, I think, for all of us to say, we've done it. We did this very basic thing. We're done. But how can we really focus on what it means? And so I started blogging and writing based on my mother's experience, based on my own experience going through medical training and as a caregiver. And that's what led me to write my blog, The Doctor is Listening, but also my book as well, called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to
Avoid. Right. And that in that book, you got into not just the power and importance of listening, but also the propensity for misdiagnoses and unnecessary tests. And you've really waged a pretty strong campaign on that. And the book is, I think, just part of what you've done in a multidimensional way. How do we get rid of all these unnecessary tests and get the misdiagnoses on track? Because obviously there's like some 12 million serious misdiagnoses made in the U.S. per year. Yet besides better listening and connecting with patients, do you have any other thoughts about how we can progress?
Three quick things. The better listening is really critical. I mean, 80%, I still find this to be astounding, right? Because if there is any test that we can invent that would give us the right diagnosis 80% of the time, we would think that this is the miraculous test. We would be investing millions, if not billions of dollars into this.
Yeah.
But instead, as a result of technology, as a result of pressures on doctors' time, we're spending less and less time listening. And so a lot of what I did in academic medicine was to teach about, look, if we can listen in the extremely busy and chaotic setting of the emergency department, and if we can really focus on our patient, not only will it save time, but it will also prevent misdiagnoses. And so teaching about listening and modeling that behavior is really important. The second is to focus on not just what the patient doesn't have, but on what it is that they do have. So we should not just say a patient comes in with chest pain and they leave with a diagnosis of chest pain. what does that really mean? Or we say, well, we've ruled out pulmonary embolism, we've ruled out an MI, we've ruled out, you know, broken ribs. But what is causing this patient's chest pain? Why are we so hesitant to say this is musculoskeletal chest pain, or to say this is GERD, or this is cholecystitis? Whatever that hesitation is, we need to get away from it as clinicians, and we also have to encourage our patients to actively be involved in this process. And the third related tip is patient empowerment. And people might think of patient empowerment as, I'm going to come to the doctor's office and bring this, you know, stack of papers and ask for 5 MRIs and 3 medications. And I'd say that's not the right approach, because that implies that you don't trust your doctor. And that implies that you know what's best. Rather, for patient empowerment, I would encourage my patients to really understand themselves, to tell a better story, to not be afraid to advocate for themselves, but in a way that's collaborative with their physician.
Oh, that's great. Now, the other thing that you have been working on really intensely, and in fact, watching your TEDMED talk, which is exceptional, and there's more than 1 million people have watched it, and we'll link that to this discussion. But you get into, you're kind of a rebel, of course, which is great. I have high regard for that. But you kind of get the docs going, because you say you need to be transparent. And, you know, the who's my doctor thing that you started. And obviously there was some backlash to that. So can you tell us a bit about that movement? Because that's in parallel to listening and connecting better with patients. It's really about establishing transparency. And I guess some doctors didn't like that too much, right?
You know, when I was a medical student, I didn't think about taking lunch from drug companies, or all of our orientation materials at orientation, there were drug company reps that were there. I mean, that was just what was done. And we never thought that there might be something wrong with this. The time that it came to my consciousness actually was when also dealing with my mother, that she had found an oncologist that she liked a lot, really trusted him. And then one day she lost his phone number and tried to look him up on the internet. And this was probably pre-Google, but she was able to use some search engine, AltaVista or something. Yeah. And she found his phone number, but she also found, because he had a fairly distinctive name, that he was a highly paid consultant for a drug company. And in fact, often spoke on behalf of the same chemo regimen that he had prescribed her. And so it made me wonder. And I was thinking not only for my mother, because it created this, you know, this barrier between her and her doctor, where she wasn't sure why he was recommending something for her, whether it was actually for her best interest or his. And I began thinking that I would never want to be that doctor where my patient is scared to come to me because they don't know why I'm prescribing a particular medication, whether it's benefiting me in some way. And so the Who's My Doctor campaign is our attempt to say, we have a responsibility to our patients to be totally transparent. Our patients are coming to us at a time of extreme vulnerability. Very few patients, if any, are going to ask me, do you take money from drug companies, right? Or are you affiliated with a medical device company? I don't think I've ever been asked that. And so it's my responsibility to monitor my own conflicts, but also to disclose it to my patients. And now
with it being voluntary, which is what you set up, it was an opt-in sort of thing. Why do you think so many doctors revolted against this concept?
You know, doctors like to think that it's the you but not me concept, right? So actually going back to when doctors don't listen, when I first wrote that book, I thought doctors are going to hate me, right? Because I'm saying that doctors aren't listening, that we should be doing better. But what I heard was doctors would say, well, I totally agree. This is a big problem in the medical profession. I'm the doctor who listens. These other doctors, they're the ones who don't listen. They're the problem. And we see the same thing when there are studies done about whether doctors perceive conflicts of interest with drug companies. And they will say, other doctors are influenced. I am not influenced. And so by disclosing, I assume that these doctors are saying, look, somehow this is implying that I am influenced and I should be immune from that. But dozens and dozens of studies show that we are influenced by drug companies advertising and marketing, or else why would they bother doing that in the first place?
Right. Well, you're definitely taking on some tough initiatives that will not make you necessarily popular in all medical circles, and you should be given a lot of credit for that. That's not easy to do it. And I know those who are listening should go to your TED Med talk and you get into the details of some of the things you had to confront. Well, it's been really great to have a chance to visit with you and for a lot of the Medscape community, physicians and health professionals to get to know you. We're going to be watching your career. You have a lot to lot more decades ahead, and you've already had an extraordinary impact at such a young age. So people, all I can say is the people in Baltimore used to be my home city back when I trained at Johns Hopkins. They're very lucky to have you. And thanks so much for joining us on Medscape. You qualify unquestionably as one of the most interesting people in medicine. Thanks, Lynn.
Well, that's extremely kind of you, Dr. Topol. Thank you very much. And I have the best job in the world. And so thank you so much for the opportunity.
Terrific. Thanks so much for joining us on the Medscape on this one-on-one with Dr. Lena Nguyen. And we look forward to bringing you some of the most extraordinary people in our medical community and some from the outside that know a lot about healthcare and medicine. Thank you.